It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the founders of World Vasectomy Day, dedicated to dispelling myths about the procedure and inspiring men to become equal partners in family planning.
First, Milwaukee's Common Council approved a contract yesterday with an Ohio-based marketing company to sell advertising on public property throughout the city.
Over the coming year, you could see advertisements go up on things like public buildings and vehicles, bike lanes, trash receptacles, and even a sponsorship for events like the 4th of July. It's a step that could raise close to $1 million a year for the city and has been used in other American cities to raise funds.
A report in the journal Sentinel shows that the city of San Diego raised $20 million between 1999 and 2012 using a similar strategy. Here with us now to talk about why Milwaukee decided to take this step is Michael Murphy, president of Milwaukee's Common Council. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me on your program.
So why did the city of Milwaukee decide to start selling naming rights to things like boulevards, recycling bins, and city events?
Well, you know, we're very much limited here in the city and generating additional revenue outside of the property taxes. We have no local sales or income tax, and there's obviously a great deal of fluctuation in state revenues we've seen over the last several years. And unfortunately, we have a situation where we have continuing rising costs. So we need to look at other ways to generate revenue that doesn't come from the property taxes and can offset some of the important things of essential services we want to continue providing to our citizens. And this is one way that we can perhaps do that, but doing it in a responsible manner.
When did this idea first get floated, and what was that initial response like?
You know, it's been floated over a number of years, but really it took off about a year ago when I introduced the legislation and we hired an outside consultant to come in and give us advice on it. But the pressures that we've been placed under, you know, we have a property tax freeze here, and the limitations of our ability to raise additional revenue has really put us in a position where we are looking at doing this much more aggressively.
How much money is Milwaukee expected to raise from selling these advertising rights?
Potentially $1 million a year. I'm hopeful that in the beginning stages we'll probably generate maybe $500,000 to $750,000. But, you know, every dollar counts when you're looking at keeping nurses, public health nurses in our schools or keeping the libraries open. You know, these essential services need to be carried out.
What is the city's total budget?
$1.45 billion.
So given that, will this really make a difference?
Well, when you talk to somebody who you hire as a public health nurse or keep a libraries open over in the evening or on weekends, I'd ask the citizens, yeah, they do think it's worth it. So there is a balance, though, but this is not something that's really particularly new. When we've been selling naming rights on buildings for quite some time, obviously the BMO Harris Center is one good example, the new Wisconsin, UWM Cellular Arena. Most citizens are not going to be that all surprised that we're doing this. But I think as a council, we recognize we don't want to become a corporate city. So we have taken certain responsible measures in place. We're not going to allow any tobacco companies, alcohol companies, or anything that would be contrary to what we think is a good image of our city.
It's interesting the range of things that are being offered up. I've read about boulevards, vehicles, bike lanes, recycling bins, garbage carts. Are advertisers really interested in all of those things?
To be perfectly frank, I was surprised. No, I didn't think somebody would be interested in some of those issues. But what we find in other cities, yeah, they are. And so, you know, we have a targeted audience. And they're looking at making sure that they get good exposure. And so some of those things have been very saleable in other cities. The first things that we're going to be looking at are probably easy fruit pickings, and that will be cell phones. So, like, we want to designate a cell phone carrier just for our city phones, or even soda rights for soda machines to be placed in all the municipal buildings. That could generate those two things alone probably over $150,000.
What kind of rules are there about what companies or what kind of messages can be advertised?
Well, the council took a very serious look at that. And so we have set up a committee, and every deal will have to be approved by the Common Council. So some of the rules and requirements that we have, they can't have any deceptive or misleading advertising. They can't be any unlawful or illegal activity. No alcohol, no tobacco products, obviously nothing dealing with pornography, anything that would deal with anyone who's potentially suing the city and could not take out an ad on a truck. So we have a fairly long list of things what is prohibited and things that are excluded, and then very clear on that in our statements.
Are there any restrictions on exactly how much advertising the city can sell? Will you reach a critical point and say, you know, that's a cap?
Yes, as soon as they reach $1.5 billion. Yeah, in all seriousness, no, we don't have a cap. I mean, San Diego obviously has raised $20 million over a 10-year period. And, you know, other cities, based on their population size, have generated substantially more money. I think we're just trying to maximize our rate of return and do it in a way which balances our city.
Now, some media critics in the past have warned about the blurring of commercial enterprise and public space. Is that a concern for the city of Milwaukee?
It is. So we'll be very sensitive to that. So I think we have to reach a balance. So we don't want to be in a situation where people feel like, you know, the corporations have bought the city of Milwaukee for a small amount of money. What we're going to do is try and make sure that how we position our city and promoting it done in a responsible way, at the same time trying to alleviate some of the pressure that we have on our budget. I mean, you know, keeping these essential services operating are very critical for our city, and literally we're fighting about in our budget, which is up for tomorrow, over $10,000 budget items. And we feel very strongly we have to figure out a way to find additional revenue that will help offset some of these costs.
There's also some concern about how these kinds of advertisements can make a city look, just in terms of its visual appeal. How will the physical appearance of Milwaukee change?
Well, I mean, good example, and one that I would look very carefully at is, for example, on boulevards. Perhaps maybe that's not something we really want to do. But, for example, if we want to wrap our sanitation trucks in, you know, by a corporate sponsor, I don't think that's going to be the end of the world if it's done in a responsible way. For example, maybe some furniture, street furniture that we have out in our community that has corporate sponsorship on. I don't think that will be negatively taking away the perception of our city. But, you know, if you ask the average citizen, you know, do you think by the fact that the BMO Harris Center was named after the Bank of Montreal, did that detract from the city's image? I think most people would say no.
Are there other cities in Wisconsin that have done this already, and have you looked to them?
I think other cities in Wisconsin have done it to a much, much smaller degree. This will be the most significant, outlay of any city in our state trying to attract and bring in sponsors.
We mentioned the city of San Diego as a city that has taken this approach, used it to great effect. Are there others like that that you can point to?
Yeah, for example, City of Miami generated in 2010 $7.2 million. The Chicago Metro generated $800,000 in 2012. The Greater Cleveland Transit Authority generated over $11 million. Minneapolis Convention Center just recently generated $1 million. So there's, you know, there's many cities around the country that have been doing this for more than 10 to 15 years. If anything, the cities have been a little bit trailing that.
And when can we expect to see these ads start going up?
I would say we're probably to sign a contract with the cell phone and the Soto company probably within the next 3 to 4 months. And then in the next 2 to 3 years, you'll probably see more of that in our community. And like I say, we want to do this in a responsible, balanced way. Would we probably not have done this if we weren't put into the position where we have these terrible fiscal pressures placed upon us with the state cutting up back on our budget? Probably, I'll be up front, probably we would not have. It's not my number one priority, but I have to think creatively to try and make sure that I keep public health nurses, libraries open, and our sanitation and our police departments properly adequate.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this.
And thanks for a great job you do. Appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Michael Murphy, president of the Milwaukee Common Council, about the city's approval yesterday of a contract to sell advertising space on public property like buildings, vehicles, bike lanes, and more. Tomorrow is World Vasectomy Day. It's a day dedicated to raising awareness about vasectomies and inspiring men to become equal partners in family planning. This year, organizers are hoping for 1,500 vasectomies in 24 hours in 30 countries.
Jonathan Stack joins us now. He's a documentary filmmaker and co-founder of World Vasectomy Day. He joins us from WFME Studios in Orlando, Florida. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Well, glad to be here.
So what is World Vasectomy Day?
World Vasectomy Day is a celebration of men who are ready, whose families are complete, and are ready to take that absolute commitment to taking on the responsibility of family planning. And it basically is an idea that came about through my own exploration, personal exploration, and it's grown into a global event in which there are almost 400 doctors who are participating in 32 countries. It takes over the course of a day, and the idea is really to bring attention to the importance of getting men to engage in conversations about family planning.
So for people unfamiliar, can you briefly describe the procedure of vasectomy? What is it? What does it do, and how is it done?
Sure. Vasectomy is a really simple procedure. It takes place, takes around 10 minutes. It's not your balls, as it were. It's really, it's just the vas, which is connects the sperm into the semen. And by making a small little, not even, nowadays you don't need a scalpel, you don't need a needle. You just separate the skin a little bit, pull out the vas, make a, you know, separate it, clamp the two sides, and boom, you're done. It takes, you got to do both sides, and you're done in 10 minutes. There's a little bit of pain afterwards, sometimes a couple of days, but for the most part, it's really not a big deal at any, you know, on a physical level. But the what it does is it means you'll never have to worry about getting somebody pregnant if you know, assuming now you're done and you don't want that anymore. It really takes a lot of pressure off yourself, and it means you do it instead of the women. It's interesting, you know, if you compare a vasectomy to a tubal ligation, which is, you know, done with women, it's so much less invasive, it's so much less painful, and it's really a way for the men to sort of step it up and say, hey, this one's on me.
Now, is there something in your background? You're a documentary filmmaker. What is it from that experience that made you want to tackle this issue?
Well, I've made a lot of films, documentary films around the world about a lot of conflict on the planet, in war zones, child soldiers, gangs, prisons. And at the center of it always was men, you know, like men disenfranchised, angry, frustrated, you know, just a lot of rage that leads to sort of so much of the evening news, you know, the violence and just the cruelty. And when I started making this film, which was really a personal film about my own journeys and my own challenges of trying to figure out maneuvering my way through fatherhood, I realized how many doubts I had, how difficult it was me to get a vasectomy. And I just sort of came to it and felt like, whoa, how wonderful was it to see men, hear stories of men who on this day, it's like a day in which they make a great, I think it's a beautiful thing and really positive. And you see the best in men. And that was really important to me because I've made so many films about the worst in men. And I think I wanted to show what men are capable of individually, doing something that's beautiful for yourself and your family. But when you put it all together, it actually has an impact on our planet and our communities. And so it was one of those things that just sat right, and it's resonated powerfully. So that's why in such a short amount of time, we've been able to build such a strong movement.
Yeah, I think people usually think of this as a very personal, private decision, whether or not to get a vasectomy. You're saying there's an element of heroism to it almost.
That's really was key. I'll tell you something. When you speak to the men who are getting their vasectomies, it's amazing. They themselves are doing it as an act of I wouldn't say sacrifice, but it's something they do for their women in their lives. Oh, every single one of tomorrow, there's going to be 29 men getting their vasectomy at our headquarters in Florida. And everyone, I've spoken to every single one, and they've all said the same thing, which was, I'm doing it for the woman in my life. And I just thought collectively putting our voices together, it's to make a really big statement to say, men, stand up. It is heroic. It's what we should be doing, which maybe for some say, well, then what makes it heroic? But I think we have to celebrate when men do the right thing, like anybody does the right thing, it's a good idea to celebrate it. And so we raise our voices together. We make our statement together. The decision, of course, is completely personal, but the impact has great social consequence.
Now, you mentioned having had a vasectomy yourself and that you were reluctant for a while. What kind of reservations were going through your head as you were making this decision?
The same that most men have all over the world, which is a slight fear of, you know, certainly the angst about losing a certain power. You know, it was like an admission of aging, that I had sort of transitioning into another phase in my life. And it's not rational, of course. I knew I didn't want any more children, but I still had a certain thing in the back of my mind that was saying, Don't do it. And it took me longer than you'd think. It was about 2 years before I actually got myself together to do it.
And let's stay with that reservation. What is it that got you to overcome that loss of a certain creative force in a way?
It was kind of realizing that I think it was listening to so many men tell their stories and hearing all these men who basically I kind of began to realize it's not macho to not take responsibility for family planning, that in fact, when you know that you are done raising, siring children or conceiving children, that it's actually the courageous thing is to do it. And that just took me that while to let go of. Certainly, I was worried I would have, would affect me sexually. I would either get or give less pleasure. But at the end of the day, I think it was a more deep psychological thing. And I was really liberated in the decision to do it because all of a sudden it was like I was in control. I was never going to have that conversation. It wasn't on my wife to figure it out. It was really my role. And it was really a powerful thing because most of my life, I had never been the primary person who was worrying about family planning.
And part of your mission with World Vasectomy Day, as I understand it, is to clear up myths and misconceptions that a lot of men have about vasectomies. What are a couple of those that you want to try to clear up?
Well, one of them, of course, is that you're less of a man, that somehow or other it makes you less virile. There are parts of the world where literally the word for vasectomy translates to castration. Same word is used for vasectomy and castration. So that has to be cleared up. It has nothing to do with castration. It has nothing to do with your sexual potency or your pleasure. It has nothing to do with your sense of who you are as a person. It's simply a way for you to gain control over your fertility. Now, some of those other concerns are that maybe that it's painful. It's not painful. I mean, is there pain in a moment? It's less pain than, getting a shot. It doesn't even come close to the pain women experience, when they have, close to what it is to get a tubal ligation. But really, all of the forms of birth control have greater and more adversarial impact, a negative impact on women than what a vasectomy does. So it's really a no-brainer. There's so many other great reasons why. I mean, if you have a vasectomy and it goes wrong, for example, the worst thing will happen is somebody will get pregnant. If you have a tubal ligation and it goes wrong, the thing that often happens is you'll end up with a tubal pregnancy, which is one of the leading causes of maternal mortality in a lot of parts of the world. So this is not small stuff. This is important things. And it's really not a big sacrifice for me at all and for men. So it's kind of like it's the right thing to do. So that's why we have to let people know, do the right thing. It feels good to do the right thing. And in World Vasectomy Day, we celebrate by acknowledging the men who do the right thing.
And on the first World Vasectomy Day last year, men participated. They got vasectomies on the day as part of the events. What kind of things did you hear from the men who had done that?
Today in Florida, or tomorrow morning at 9:30, we're going to be – one of the first Skype calls we'll be making. We're going to be live casting from our website, worldvasectomyday.org, so everybody can watch it. It's going to be taking place over the course of around 8 hours. And one of our first calls is with the man who got the first vasectomy last year. And every single person that I've spoken to, and they've sent in testimonials, are basically just saying it just did exactly what they wanted it to do. It's the absence of fear or the absence of anxiety. Once you do it, you just go on with your life. And it's just now you don't have that. You're not worried about getting your wife or partner, or if you're single, you're not worried about getting anybody pregnant. And if you know that's what you want, that's a great relief.
And the live stream you mentioned, is that graphic watching for people at home?
Out of respect for both the viewers and for the men themselves, it's not, we're not going to be showing any private parts that would make anybody uncomfortable. The procedure is so simple that it's really not it's not that interesting. In fact, what makes the live event particularly interesting is that while a vasectomy is happening, we'll be conversing and having conversations with the men, their wives, their mothers. Families are coming in, and it's a beautiful thing. It's kind of to celebrate what's really is it is a meaningful moment. I mean, the day that you consciously choose to exit the gene pool because you are complete in that part of your life, it's a beautiful thing. And that's all we're trying to do is like say this moment, this is a good thing to be able to acknowledge and celebrate men doing the right thing.
We're talking to documentary filmmaker Jonathan Stack about World Vasectomy Day. He's the co-founder, and the event takes place tomorrow.
You can join the conversation. Do you think men should be equal partners in family planning? How do you think they should fulfill that role? Have you or your partner gotten a vasectomy? And why did you decide to do it? What was that experience like? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll pick up this discussion coming up after the news. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with documentary filmmaker Jonathan Stack about World Vasectomy Day, which is tomorrow.
And you can join the conversation. Have you or your partner gotten a vasectomy? What was it like? What fears did you have before the procedure? How do you think men should participate in family planning? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Racine. Joe, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Joe?
Well, I had my vasectomy about 45 years ago and never regretted it once. I had five children at the age of 25, and that limited the size of my family to what I could afford. And I always tell people that I converted myself from a working model to a sports model.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Apart from the joke there, Jonathan, is that a fairly common story?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there is no age in which you can say this is the age to get a vasectomy or this is not a good age. We don't really determine that. There are some people who know their family's complete when they have one child. There are people who don't want any children. There are people who, you know, want 10 children. That's not really our decision to impact. We just basically say at the moment when you know you have the size family that works for you, the vasectomy is a great option. I got to tell you, there was one guy that we were filming with, and he was telling us a story about how he couldn't find a vasectomy provider who would get him a vasectomy because he was only 24, 25 years old and had no children. And he had just come back from Iraq, and he was saying, how is it that I'm old enough to die or kill for my country, but I don't have the right to decide I just don't want to bring children into this world? I can always adapt, but I didn't want to bring children into the world. And that just raises good questions. Dr. Stein, who's my partner in this project, he said, well, why don't you go freeze some sperm just in case?
And Joe did deal with it with a sense of humor. Do you see that as a pretty common theme with the people you've talked to?
I think you just say the word vasectomy and there's kind of a bit of humor. It's a little titillation thing and it's just, you know, it's a personal thing. Men don't necessarily talk about our personal lives openly. And yet, you know, there's a sort of a release of it and a relief that comes with it, and that's a component of humor for sure.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Sarah with us in Viroqua. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I'm a public and community health nurse, and when I travel, I kind of enjoy looking for health messages. Earlier this year, I traveled to Mexico, and on the outside of a clinic, there was a banner which had a photograph of a wrestler, one of the entertainment type wrestlers in Mexico that wear the tight, shiny suit and the mask and this kind of the superhero costume. Mm-hmm. In one arm, he was holding a 2 or 3 year old child, and the other he was sort of had up in the air in a fist. And the copy said something to the extent about be a man, have a vasectomy, be a good family man, play your part. And I just thought that it was really a great positive message, a bit of a transformation of the concept of what macho means, and just really positive messaging for what for families making choices, for men playing their role in family planning and making reproductive choices. And anyway, just really enjoyed that.
And Sarah, as somebody in public health, what do you think of this idea of World Vasectomy Day tomorrow?
I think it's a really good idea. I am constantly surprised when I share that my husband had a vasectomy after we had our two children. Prior to that, I was in charge of our family planning. I used contraception myself, but after we decided that we didn't want any more kids, we decided our best choice was that. And I am surprised that that isn't a choice more couples make.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. So we heard a perspective there, Jonathan, as a public health worker, but also as a wife of a husband who got a vasectomy. Take both of those in turn. Do you hear similar stories?
Yeah, very much. I think the story of public health workers, I mean, they just know it. They know the importance of reaching out and getting men to participate. It's not just about inspiring the men to do a vasectomy. It's really inspiring them to be part of the conversation, that it's really important to have that conversation. I mean, you may decide you don't want to have a vasectomy or you don't want to stop having children. That's good. That's fine. What's important is to have the conversation. And I believe that if you can have a conversation about this topic, which is a difficult one, a lot of other things will come flow easier as well. And, you know, 51% of children born in America are unintended. They're just as wonderful and as magnificent as any other child. But I think life causes more stress when you're not prepared. And so many of the people we meet had made a decision to stop having children at 2 or 3. And then there was that child who came, and that's when they show up for the vasectomy. And we just would say, hey, you know, that fourth child or third child, as beautiful as the first 2 or 3, no problem. But I think life would be a little bit easier for those couples and maybe a little more resources for the children if they had, when they knew they didn't want more children, if they'd taken that step. And that's really what World Vasectomy Day is. And as far as, you know, getting that health message out and using humor and that notion of like a redefining of what it is to be macho. I mean, I don't think there's anything particularly macho about getting somebody pregnant. It's not that original. I mean, there's 7.3 billion people on the planet, so it's like not that big a deal to create life. I think what's really more macho, if you want to call it that, is the capacity to raise your children well, to provide for them as you would want, and to be able to really experience and share love. And that's what it is. It's very loving. You know, it's a very loving moment if you make this as a conscious choice.
Back to our callers now with Lynn in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there, good afternoon. Over 31 years now ago, during my fourth pregnancy, my husband and I made the decision that there would be no more. And it just like your guest just said, it's anybody can father or a child. But we had enough, and I had had three sons, and thankfully, you know, I had a daughter, number four. But it was 20 years down the road when I could no longer have children, that he understood what I was going through. I mean, so there was a benefit to me, which I really appreciated later when he understood how I felt. That I could no longer have children or you know, or ever get pregnant again, and it was a gift that he gave to his family. We could afford the four kids we had, and it made us closer. And like I said, you know, 20 years later, it was a bonus.
Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your story. So, a gift he gave his family, first of all, Jonathan.
I think of the 29 men, and I spoke with each of them. Several of them told me that when they made the decision and they told their wife that they were going to go do this, that they cried. That it was the most beautiful, loving thing gift that they could give their wife or their partner. And I think it was just like, it's sort of, you know, we want to experience the best of who we are. You know, humans have a huge range of capacity of expression. The same person who can be very kind could be a bit cruel. And, you know, celebrating the kind part of ourselves, the compassionate part, the conscious part of ourselves just makes it more prevalent. And that has a ripple effect down through our lives, as we just heard. You know, just that was that moment in which you did something for me after all those years that women do so many beautiful things for us.
As we wrap up, Jonathan, are you looking to expand next year's World Vasectomy Day to more sites around the country, maybe around the world?
You know, what's amazing about the project so far is that it's expanding on its own. I think it's a movement that's time has come. It's going to obviously expand because more and more groups are seeing, you know, the power of, you know, aggregating positive energy. So I would guess, you know, last year this year we said we were going to try to have 250 doctors from 30 countries participate, and we're already at 32 countries, and there are 400 doctors, and I think by next year we will double that again, and I just think it's going to take on a life of its own, and people will find their own way to celebrate it and their own way to communicate it, and it's just something that I don't think is going to stop. I don't know, you know, that's when you have a powerful idea is when it sort of lives beyond your own initial imagination.
Well, Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you all, and go watch it tomorrow, worldvasectomyday.org. You can watch it live streaming, meet the men, meet the doctors, hear conversations, be part of it.
That was Jonathan Stack, documentary filmmaker and co-founder of World Vasectomy Day. You can keep the conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page. What makes a great toy? The National Toy Hall of Fame has been answering that question for years now, and you can too. Call in with your favorite toy of all time at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
The Toy Hall of Fame announced three new inductees earlier today, and here to share them is Chris Bench. He's vice president for collections at the Strong Museum in Rochester, New York. The museum includes the National Toy Hall of Fame and the International Center for the History of Electronic Games. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Well, so before we get to the good news of the three new inductees, Chris, what makes a great toy worthy of the Hall of Fame?
Well, first of all, these are toys that have staying power. They've got longevity. To qualify for the National Toy Hall of Fame, a toy has to have been on the market for at least 20 years so that kids and their parents could have both grown up playing it. And second, these are toys that are iconic. Everybody can recognize them. Whether you played with them or not, you can probably tell a Barbie from a hula hoop from a Lego brick. And finally, these are toys that encourage learning, creativity, and discovery. They're the ones that have the best qualities of play about them, not the ones that you press a button, it does its little shtick, and 5 minutes later, you're playing with the box that it came in.
And we'll invite our listeners to share the toys that met that description for them. Your favorite toy, your memorable toy of all time. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, Chris, let's end the suspense here and start getting to some of the inductees. The Rubik's Cube made it this year.
It did. It was a five-time previous finalist for the National Toy Hall of Fame, and I was starting to think that it was going to turn out to be the Susan Lucci of the toy world, always snubbed for her Emmy. Well, the Rubik's Cube finally made it in this year, its sixth try, and beautifully on the 40th anniversary of its invention.
And it's sort of amazing how long, you know, the legacy of Rubik's Cube has lasted. People are still solving it in new and amazing ways.
They are, and for the occasion, we assembled a Rubik's Cube mosaic depicting a Rubik's Cube composed entirely of dozens of Rubik's Cubes. So you don't just have to solve the cube, you can use it as artwork, too.
And then another inductee, and this is a toy that was all over when I was a kid. I don't know if they still are. I took it for granted. The Little Green Army Men. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of those little plastic, inflexible dudes?
Well, they've been around since the 1930s, and they grew out of metal toy soldiers before that. But the beauty of Little Green Army Men has always been that you buy them by the bagful, the binful. They're so inexpensive. You can have an entire battalion, an amazing engagement that you set up on the living room carpet, in the sandbox, in the backyard, and they are, frankly, cannon fodder. They're expendable. So if you lose one, it's not a disaster, and you can go add to your group tomorrow.
And then the third inductee, this is a great one. I wouldn't have thought, you know, that it was a toy, but I guess it's a staple of childhood for sure. Bubbles.
Bubble solution is something that we consider a staple of every drugstore or mass market discount store, and they have been around for more than 400 years. Wish I could have met the first kid who was having a bath and those soap suds said not just getting clean, but the opportunity for fun.
And they come, like, it's not like there's a patent on bubbles, right? There are zillions of makes and models, and some that are sadistic, and the little wands that are not the right shape or size, you can't make a bubble happen. They could be frustrating, but usually they're a lot of fun.
They are, and I think that's a key developmental phase for kids to be able to blow just hard enough that they expand that bubble and don't just splatter soap suds everywhere.
Well, we've got some callers on the line who want to share their favorite toys. We have Amanda joining us in De Pere. Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
What is your vote for favorite toy?
I remember playing with Lincoln Logs at my grandparents. My dad played with them. My grandparents played with them. They're just that kind of novelty toy that a lot of kids have played with.
That's a great one. Yeah, I've got a set of those sitting in my basement right now. The kids are not currently in the Lincoln Log phase, but they seem to be sort of an evergreen toy, don't they?
Yeah.
They have been around, and they're in the Hall of Fame. They were inducted in 1999.
And, Chris, a lot of times, as I look through the list of things on the Toy Hall of Fame, it's not the fancy stuff, the shiny stuff, but a lot of simple things that are flexible that you can kind of do what you want with them that really seem to make a lot of the classic toys what they are.
That's right. That kind of open-ended play that isn't reliant on necessarily batteries or a character's backstory. You bring so much to it, and it expands who you are.
We have a comment here on Facebook from Jen who writes, my original issue Cabbage Patch Kid is her vote for Toy Hall of Fame. I got her the year everyone was fighting over them. I bawled when I opened her. Christmas 84 was the best Christmas ever, she says, thanks to the Cabbage Patch Kid. Are they in there?
They are not. Cabbage Patch Kids have been finalists on a number of occasions, and I'm confident for the impact they've had not only on individual lives, but the whole sort of cultural dynamic that there could be a cute, ugly, appealing doll that was different from anything that came before it, and it will earn a place eventually, I'm sure.
Well, I wonder, Chris, is that one that stands the test of the time, really? Because it was a huge fad. I remember even, you know, as a teen then, I didn't have my own Cabbage Patch, but I remember all the news stories about stores getting cleaned out 2 minutes after they open. But Cabbage Patch, nobody today is like hankering for a Cabbage Patch Kid, except maybe the kids nostalgic for the ones they had in the 80s.
Well, they may not be the craze that they once were, but they've shown that they can stick around, they can endure, you can still find them on shelves today. And funny how some of these things have resurgences. Often we see toys making a return as parents say, oh, I grew up with that item, my kid will turn out great like I did if only they have a blank radio flyer wagon, Cabbage Patch doll, and they have a sort of 25-year cycle often.
What are some of the nominees that didn't make it in this year?
Sadly, American Girl Dolls, Fisher-Price Little People, My Little Pony, they were also Rans this year.
So if a toy doesn't make it in, do they get another shot in subsequent years?
Absolutely. This is not three strikes and you're out, or you have a limited window that you are eligible. This is... those same toys could be back next year or the year after that. So they've got another chance at the big prize.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Gail with us in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I was wondering if the Breyer horse statues are in there, because I know I've had the same ones that I got over 50 years ago for a Christmas present.
What is the Breyer horse statue?
Breyer horses are not yet in the National Toy Hall of Fame, and I have lobbied for them personally, having grown up with a sister who went through an intense horse phase and actually grew up to become a veterinarian.
You're stumping me here, Chris. Is this a plastic horse toy, or is it something the rocking thing you ride on?
It's a plastic horse toy. It's about usually 8 to 10 inches tall. Sometimes they're famous horses like Misty of Chincoteague from that famous children's book, but others are just horses that allow you to have your own riding ranch on the bedroom floor.
I may have had those. I had a whole big horse collection when I was a kid, but I don't know if they were Briar horses or not, but it's nice to see horses represented.
Yeah, I think I might have been in a parallel universe. I don't remember those. We've got a picture on our screen here, which doesn't help anybody listening, but okay. I guess I've seen this before.
Plastic horses. Okay, let's go to Karen next. Karen joins us in Viroqua. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, what do you vote for Toy Hall of Fame?
I vote for the original Mr. Potato Head, the interactive one, the one that every time was a little different because you used a real potato.
Oh, okay, yeah. As I understand it, and this may be from you on a past show on our morning show, Chris, the original Mr. Potato Head, you had the pieces and you plugged them into actual potatoes, right?
That is right, and that was not so savory when those potatoes got punctured and left under the kid's bed. And
you can't throw them away, Mom. I love him.
Well, I didn't know that there were any real Mr. Potato Heads. I loved my Mr. Potato Head, but it was the plastic kind. Yeah, definitely
That's
fun
what
toy.
I had too. Yeah.
Are they in the Hall of Fame in any iteration?
They are in the Hall of Fame, both in the plastic and the potato version.
Nice.
We heard from Barb writing on Facebook. She says, I loved Spirograph, but I could never make my designs as good as the ones in the box. I had the same frustration. Is that another important developmental phase, Chris?
That is, and I have experienced that myself, cranking them around and just can't get it smooth enough to get that incredibly complex geometric shape going.
Chris, are there any newer toys that are on the cusp of being inducted?
You know, there are people who are advocating that the iPhone is the ultimate plaything of our time for kids and adults alike. So maybe it is on the verge of entering into the National Toy Hall of Fame another year.
As we play on gadgets more and more, are the classics losing steam, or is there still room for rubber balls, which I think got inducted a couple years ago, and Legos and Lincoln Logs?
I like to think that kids will always have a mix of electronic and non-electronic playthings. I think most kids view it as a whole play universe and don't necessarily segregate or stop, okay, I've had enough of this physical play. It's time for me to sit down with my little shiny screen. It's all part of a continuum. And I hope for kids' health that we always have that kind of blend, including toys, electronic play, and outdoor play in the mix of growing up.
And Chris, you obviously know from toys. So what is your favorite toy of all time?
As a kid, I loved my toy cars best of all. So I was a Matchbox guy. I was a little old for when Hot Wheels came out, but I had a few too because they were faster than anything I had ever seen before.
Great. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the new inductees.
Pleasure being with you.
That was Chris Bench with the National Toy Hall of Fame telling us about the three new members of that club.
You can keep sharing your favorite toys on the Central Time Facebook page. I remember the G.I. Joe, the smaller guys, the later models when I was a kid, and Legos, and often I would combine the two.
Aha. Uh-huh. Little mashup toy thing there.
Yeah, did you have a favorite? And of course, Legos came back with my kids, too, and I got to play with them.
I loved my Star Wars figures.
Yeah, except they didn't bend at the knees and elbows. They had a disadvantage against G.I. Joe, right?
If I hadn't mashed them up, though, they'd be worth so much money now.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
My big regret.